microphone on. It being 3:01, I'm going to call this meeting of the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee to order. Members, first item on the agenda is the approval of the Tuesday, April 1st minutes. Representative Hemmingson Yeager, have you had the opportunity to review yesterday's minutes? Okay. All right. That's okay. They are an electronic version of the minutes. You know what? We'll put this at the back of the agenda and we'll figure it out. We will remember. We have Representative Pinto back with us today. We had good conversation on House File 1367 and questions on that and testimony. There was a little bit of a confusion on where the bill was going, so we're going to pick the bill up off the table or wherever it was, and we are going to send it on to the General Register. So I will move that House File 1367 be re-referred or be sent to the General Register. Chair Pinto, you want to give us a brief recap of the bill?
Thank you, Chair Cadiz-Witun. Thank you, Chair West and members. Just to remind you of the bill we heard yesterday, this is a bill that closes a loophole, a really unfortunate loophole, that prevents the investigation of abuse or molestation that occurs to children who are Minnesota residents but occurs when they are temporarily out of state. And so this closed the loophole brought to us by the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Important to close this and really would appreciate your support today. Thank you, Chair.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Pinto. So members, we did have opportunity for member questions yesterday. I'm going to go right ahead and renew my motion to send House File 1367 on to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Right. The motion prevails, and you are on your way to the General Register.
Thank you
for joining us again.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chairs. Thank you, members.
Next on the agenda, we have an informational hearing, House File 1685 from Representative Kraft. Thanks for joining us, Representative Kraft. This is an informational-only hearing, so no official action will be taken. So you can go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair and committee members. So when I first heard about this idea, it struck me as just fantastic common sense. As I dug into it more with some of the numbers and potential impacts, it made even more sense, and I hope you'll agree with me. Metro Transit has a Transit Assistance Program, or TAP, that is designed to make public transit more affordable for people with lower incomes, provides a year-long reduced fare pass on a go-to card where folks can use transit for a dollar per ride. One of the biggest challenges with the program is awareness. In 2024, only about 11,500 unique users took advantage of the program, about 4,500 per month, yet about 500,000 in the metro area are eligible. So what this bill does is ask that a link be created from the place where people apply for SNAP benefits, this is the connection to here, to the TAP application. By the way, from DHS, approximately 150,000 folks in the metro area apply for SNAP benefits each year. So if just 1% of those learn about and use the TAP program with this integration, it's about a 15% increase in yearly usage of TAP. If 10% do, then the increase would be something like 150%. And that increased usage would likely build on itself every year. So by making a simple integration that will cost about $35,000 that will be funded out of the state gov budget. We'd be helping more income-challenged folks cost-effectively get around as they live their lives, increase the amount of revenue Metro Transit receives. Even at the low end of my estimates, it would pay for itself in less than 6 months. At the higher end, it would pay for itself in less than a month. And we'd increase ridership on transit. And by the way, increased ridership is known to improve safety. So I'm excited about this, happy to take any questions, but I'm going to first turn it over to my testifier.
Certainly. Thank you for that introduction, Representative Kraft. We have Naz Nurkadi, if you could introduce yourself for the record. Sorry if I mispronounced your name, and proceed with your testimony.
No, you did a great job. I'm Naz Nurkadi. I'm the state policy lead for Move Minnesota Action. Thank you to the chair and the committee for having me. It's my first time speaking in your committee. Move Minnesota Action is a place where we fight for walking, biking, and most relevantly to this policy, transit. Outside of the advocacy side of my work, I do a ton of transit canvassing. I've conducted now almost about 1,000 interviews with transit riders and non-transit riders alike in the last 2 years to discuss how to envision a better transit system for us. I hold a ton of stories, and it's my responsibility to advocate for those who have confided in me. The need for the legislation is clear for three reasons and others. One, people are struggling. I'll spare you the horror stories, I'm sure you're aware. Two, the transit assistance program works well. Metro Transit and recipients like the program. Three, enrollment, once again, is not great. I think Metro Transit does an okay job of trying to advertise it, but as the numbers we've just heard from Kraft, we know that it's not enough. We advertise and talk about the benefits portal as if it's the consolidated list of ways to alleviate your difficult financial situation. Yet the transit assistance program is missing from the list. This is a matter of efficiency and awareness. It's our responsibility to ensure that every program that exists to help our most vulnerable is presented in front of us. Satisfied TAP recipients have told me various obscure ways they've heard of the program, whispers at encampments, word of mouth from other recipients, scouring the Metro Transit website to see if they did giveaway for transit cards, etc. This is an easy bill. We should prioritize efficiency and ease in how we get our services to our neighbors. Thanks so much for your time today. Thank you to Representative Kraft, and thank you again for all of you for having me.
Thank you so much for your testimony and joining us today. All right, members, just for a little bit of clarity, this bill currently resides within the purview of the state government committee. Various discussions between chairs have been taking place over whose budget this money would come out of. And while it is a direct impact to DCYF because of the connection and integration with the SNAP application portal, it is run through MNIT, which falls under the jurisdiction of the state government committee. So the funding would not come out of our budget. And I've also spoken with Chair Kosnick of the Transportation Committee, obviously very closely linked, and he is discussing whether or not you'll do an informational hearing in that committee as well. So any other members of the public who wish to speak to House File 1685? Seeing none, I will close public testimony and move to member questions. Representative McDonald.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kraft, because this is already being done through the Met Council, correct? They already have a program similar to this or the very program. Is that correct?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative McDonald, yes, they have a program, the Transit Assistance Program, that exists today. This is about getting more visibility to it. One of their big challenges is awareness of the program.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, thank you. Representative Kraft, you did mention that, I think, in your opening, so I was paying attention, listening, but I wasn't exactly clear on how it would bring awareness to it that the Met Council program is not doing. What are they not doing that your new bill would create that would be doing it better?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this would integrate the application in with when folks apply for SNAP benefits on the MIN benefits portal. And about 150,000 folks from the metro area go there every year in applying for benefits. And so this would, as they were applying for food benefits, other things, they'd be able to see it right there. Hey, have you thought about, do you need some transit benefits? So it's simply putting the information in the and a link to the application where people are going that would very likely be able to be served by this program.
Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair. Representative Kraft, yes, now I recall you said that as well. I heard that as well. You know, it's difficult sometimes, a challenge to be reading material and the bills and listening to the testify, but sometimes I master both. And it's a dollar, is that correct, that they'd be assistance in the writing? Is that correct?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the way the program works is if you have this card, it's a dollar a ride.
Any further follow-up, Representative McDonald?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kraft, show, got to turn it on.
Everybody's doing that job. All right, so it's $35,000 to implement this into the benefits portal. Is there a cost with increased use of a reduced fare?
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair West. Well, I mean, the question comes down to if everyone that finds out about it is already using transit, then it might lower the amount a little bit. But if you actually look at the penetration of transit in the metro area, it's about 4% of people. And if you look at how little this program is used today, then the likelihood is that most people, I think the reasonable likelihood is that most people finding out about this won't have been using it already, won't have been using transit. So it's a net, I think it's going to be a net increase in the amount of folks using transit and a net increase in revenue to Metro Transit.
Chair West.
I can't imagine it's a very impressive net increase of revenue at a dollar a ride. There's a reason it costs more than a dollar to generally ride it for the average person. But we'll see how expensive it is if this does go through. It's an interesting idea.
Representative Sensomira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this bill. Thinking a little bit about some of your comments, Chair West, you know, one of the things that comes to mind for me, and I know you know this as someone who was on the Transportation Committee with Representative Kraft and I last year, is just how do we bring back transit coming out of the pandemic where we had lower ridership, and we know that lower ridership often leads to kind of more safety concerns. Like, I think that there are a lot of benefits to the system, some that can actually show up monetarily, about like having full buses, people feel more comfortable, there's less safety concerns. So I think anything that's helping people use transit, especially if they need it, is a good thing. And, I'll just say, side comment, as someone who's on the Transportation Committee and the Children and Families Committee, I think, you know, having this come out of a state government budget is the right decision.
I agree. We have Representative Nadeau on the list, and then members, we're going to close member discussion and move on to the next bill since this is just informational. Go ahead, Representative Nadeau.
We love informational, bills. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kraft. I'm wondering, have you talked with, most of, when you go to the Min Benefit site, which is an important site, most of the people that qualify for SNAP and Diversionary Work Program and MFIP, people like that, they're eligible for free rides under Metro Transit. And those are provided through the MFIT program, through the Diversionary Work Program. And so I'm just wondering, I'm not familiar with the Metro Transit Assistance Program. If you've talked to the program, I believe that most of the M benefit programs provide actual free bus cards. And so why would they pay a dollar if they can get them for free? And if you've talked to Metro Transit about, I'm all about, let's get more people on our public transit programs. I mean, because they're not riding. I mean, if you look at, our fare box recovery ratios are abysmal. And so I'm all about, let's put more people on empty buses and try to get, more people wherever they are. I'm just wondering if, it seems to me like there's an eligibility differentiation here.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau. So I have spoken with Metro Transit about this. They feel that this will be, they're pretty excited about it, the potential for an increase, given everything you said. But I'm also going to ask my testifier, he's got something maybe to add.
Absolutely.
Mr. Norcotti, excuse me.
Yes. Thank you, Chair, and also thank you, Representative. This policy was developed alongside conversations with the DHS and as well as Metro Transit. And one of the things that they've really wanted is an increased amount of usage in this specific program. It's something that they're looking for. As these rides aren't completely free, one of the use cases is the alleviation of people's financial situations, but it's also a potential increase in revenue that comes with the potential increase in ridership. We want to fill up our buses. We want to bring people in our trains as well. And this system and the usage of the TAP program, which they're particularly fond of, allows for all of those things simultaneously.
Representative Nadeau? All right. Very good. Representative Kraft, any closing comments for us?
Yeah, I really thank you for your time, Madam Chair and members, for fitting this in. The good thing about this is I think it does make just common sense, and it's not a lot of money to for, even if it winds up being modest benefits, it pays for itself pretty rapidly, and we can make it easier for some folks that need it to get around. So thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us. That was informational only, so no action is taken. We are going to revisit the minutes discussion right now, members. We all had electronic minutes. Representative Hemmingsen-Yeager, do you have a motion for the minutes of
so
April
moved.
Fool's Day? Representative Hemmingsen-Yeager moves approval of the April 1st minutes. Any discussion to those minutes or that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? All right. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Lauren is helping us set up Zoom for our next bill, and we are going to move to House File 2732 from Representative Purcell. Thank you for joining us today. You can go ahead and share your proposal.
Thank you, Chair Katiza Watun, Co-Chair West, and members. This is my first time in front of your committee, and I am honored to be here to present House File 2732. This is a bill to help with rural childcare. As we know, that is a big struggle in rural parts of Minnesota. I mean, it's a struggle everywhere. You all know this better than most. And so this is a particular bill to get increased funding to our rural child care providers. The structure of the program is just like the compensation support program. And the one part of the bill that I think is unique, subdivision 7, the eligible uses of money, expands some of those uses to include rent, equipment, training, compensation, and benefits. And there is not a dollar amount in here, so as you see fit and have available, this would go a long way to helping our child care providers stay open and continuing to create, to provide great care for our littles in greater Minnesota. And I have two testifiers. They are both online, hopefully now or soon.
Thank you for the introduction, Representative Purcell. Yep, we are getting our technology connected, and hopefully very shortly we'll have your testifiers in the room with us. Members, do you have any questions while we wait to hear from our Zoom testifiers? I think a candy break is being suggested, so we are going to recess for a very brief tech. Oh, look it! I tricked you all. That's how it happens, right? Your computer doesn't work until you do something else. So the Zoom room is getting set up, and first on the list we have Tawna Schneider. If you can unmute yourself and introduce yourself for the record, we would love to hear from you. Ms. Schneider, if you can hear me, you can unmute yourself and try to introduce yourself. I want to make sure the audio is connected properly. Yeah, I'm seeing that Ms. Schneider is still muted. There we go. We also have Karen DeVos on the line. Karen, if you can hear me, do you want to try to unmute yourself? Oh, Tawna, all right, it looks like you've unmuted yourself. Can't hear you yet.
Oh. She's listening to the Zoom, or the YouTube.
Okay, there's a bit of a delay. Oh. Okay. Ms. Schneider, if you could try to talk to us again. Yes, to some extent. Can you move the microphone a little bit closer to the speaker? All right, try to go ahead now.
Okay, thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is Tana Schneider, and I am the owner and director of the Village Early Learning Center in Dundas. Prior to opening the only center in Dundas in 2021, I owned and operated a licensed in-home child care for almost 11 years. I am testifying to express my strong support for House File 2732, which seeks to establish the Rural Child Care Stabilization and Support Payments Program. This initiative is vital for sustaining and enhancing child care services in our rural communities. Dundas is a small but growing city in Rice County with a population that has increased significantly over the past two decades. According to the 2020 census, or U.S. Census, Dundas had a population of 1,712, a substantial rise from 547 in 2000. This growth reflects Dundas's appeal as a family-friendly community with a median age of 36 years and approximately 29% of residents under the age of 18. However, the increasing number of young families has intensified the demand for quality childcare services. Currently, Dundas hosts a limited number of childcare facilities, including my center, along with a couple of in-home family providers. The availability of childcare slots remains insufficient to meet the needs of our growing community. The proposed program under this bill would offer much needed financial support to childcare providers in small cities like Dundas, enabling us to maintain and enhance our services, as well as possibly even expanding our center to create more space for families throughout the community. This support is crucial for addressing operational challenges, improving staff compensation, and ensuring the provision of high quality early childhood education. Furthermore, the bill's provision for increased payments to programs in areas with limited childcare access of socioeconomic challenges demonstrates a commitment to equity and recognize the heightened needs of certain rural areas. I strongly urge you to support this bill and invest in the future of our children and the vitality of rural Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Schneider, for being patient with the technology here and for joining us today. Coley, do we think that it's possible to connect it on the actual screen so that it runs through the room sound system instead of your computer?
I promise we had a tight 5 minutes, but
Representative Purcell, we appreciate you being here and for bringing the voices of rural business owners to the table. And you know, this is one of the pros and cons of technology and being in the childcare industry. I see Representative Nadeau has a question, so go ahead, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And since we have some time, can you just, I was looking through here and I see where non-licensed or illegal non-licensed can apply up to $500, and I see the other eligible. How, what was your thought on the amount that a provider or a provider staff, like an aggregate amount that someone would be eligible for under your proposed program?
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Nadeau. I'm not particularly attached to those numbers, so I would certainly be open to conversation around that.
One of the things that we've discussed with the Great Start compensation payments, the average is about $375 for the existing program, and then for this additional infusion of investment for rural providers, I think, you know, we could discuss that one, what it looks like.
Absolutely.
Representative Nadeau, follow up?
Please. Are they ineligible for current program dollars?
It's It is my understanding, and Representative Purcell, you can confirm this, that this would be in addition to the existing Great Start compensation payments, particularly for rural providers. Representative Nadeau.
And thank you. And so I did see that this is limited to populations of under 2,500 people. So that's where it would be an add-on for super small, well, small communities. But I also noticed that there's an additional requirement that it has to be areas of concentrated poverty, areas of low access. So do you know, like, how many child care providers would actually qualify with these strict requirements?
Representative Purcell.
I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, but I would venture to guess that there is an incredible overlap. The Venn diagram of those things is significant.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Purcell.
We are going to again try to bring one of our testifiers on the line. Ms. DeVos, if you could unmute yourself and try to introduce yourself. Hopefully we can hear you. You're still muted, if you can hear us. Oh, there you go.
Okay, I think.
Yes.
Yep, I think I'm unmuted.
And you're unmuted, and we can hear you throughout the room. Go right ahead with your testimony. You can introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. I'm so sorry. I'm having a hard time deciphering what anybody is saying, but I'm assuming that you're going to have me move forward with my testimony.
Yes, please.
Perfect. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Karen DeVos. I am the owner and director of Little Learners Early Child Care Centers with site in Ada and Elkhead, Minnesota. We're in the northwest part of the state in Norman County. Little Learners has the only licensed child care centers in Norman County. We currently have two sites serving nearly 90 children, and we are adding a third location beginning next week that will serve 16 infants. We will be serving 110 children approximately from Ada, Halsted, and the surrounding rural communities. The next closest center to us is more than 40 miles away. I'm here today because child care in Greater Minnesota is in crisis. Providers like me are doing everything that we can to stay open, but the numbers don't add up. I personally went without a paycheck for about 3 years after we opened our first child care center site so that we wouldn't have to turn families away. Even now, there are times that I worry about whether or not I'm going to get paid because I want to make sure that my staff is being compensated appropriately. We take children whose parents rely on assistance, but that reimbursement doesn't cover the actual cost of care. And like so many others, we are stretched to the breaking point. This is not just my story. Across the state, especially in rural communities, childcare programs are closing. Providers are burning out, families can't find care, and when they can, it's often unaffordable. This impacts every sector. Businesses can't hire or keep employees because there's nowhere for their children to go during the day. House File 2732 offers a real solution. It would provide direct, ongoing support to rural providers, helping us to stabilize, pay our staff a fair wage, and continue serving our communities. Without support like this, more centers will close, more families will be left without care, and more rural towns will lose the workers and families that they rely on. I ask that you please support House File 2732. This is more about, it's about more than just early learning, which is so incredibly important, but it's also about saving childcare in rural Minnesota and protecting the future of our small rural communities. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us and for sharing your experience. All right, members, we'll move on to additional questions for the representative or the testifiers now that we're online. I really appreciate, Representative Purcell, you bringing this bill to highlight some of the unique challenges that our Greater Minnesota communities face in this space. And think that it's something that we all recognize, and I think that whatever we can do to support rural providers, but all providers all across the state, is something that's a top priority for this committee. So seeing no other questions, I'll allow you to have closing comments.
Thank you, especially for your grace and your patience with our technical difficulties. Thank you to the staff, and thanks so much for hearing the bill and to the testifiers.
We are going to lay over House File 2732. Right. Also for the record, Chair West, who is a former Geek Squad employee, fixed the technical difficulties that we were having, and thank you for that. Also, he used to work at Costco. I think, you know, now that we're talking about your work history, this reminds me of former representative, now Senator Lucero, who has a very impressive backlog of work experience, that we kept a running list in Commerce about every time he mentioned what he used to do, or when he actually used to work for the Eden Prairie Police Department at one point in time. So that was a interesting connection. Anyway. I digress. We will move on to House File 1897, now that Representative Chair Moeller is here with us in the room. Go ahead. We're also going to lay this bill over. It looks like you do have a DE1 amendment. So I, to get the bill in the shape that the author would like, I'll go ahead and move the DE1 amendment, and we'll just adopt it now, members, and then she can present on the bill as amended. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. The motion prevails, and the DE1 is adopted. Representative Moeller, to your bill as amended. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair West, and members of the committee. So my constituent, Brenda, is a family care, child care provider in my district, and she and I and other family child care providers have been in conversation for years regarding some of the barriers that she and other family providers face as they care for children. Protecting our children who are in these settings is always the highest priority. It's also important to support good providers in this climate when families are struggling to find and pay for childcare. And one way we can do that is providing due process to providers who have received correction orders. Currently, when a correction order is issued by the agency, they're sent a letter to both the provider, and then they publicly post that letter. And there are a few problems with this. First, the letters themselves can be quite inflammatory. The public certainly has a right to know, but not in the form of the letter posted online, where a summary will serve the job. These letters, in addition to listing the current violation, list previous violations, and some of those things are, like, I would say very minor. For example, I saw one that had a laundry list of items, including failure to be prepared for severe weather when your radio was missing batteries. Second, the posting of the letter happens before the provider has had the opportunity to request reconsideration, and occurs even if ultimately the reconsideration is granted. For centers, on the other hand, the corrections orders, if they're under reconsideration, that reconsideration is noted, but it's not noted on the lookup system for the family providers. Third, the letters are left up for 4 years after, and sometimes longer by mistake, while the federal law only requires 3 years. And then finally, unlike centers where individuals aren't named, family providers, of course, their names and addresses are listed. It's also my understanding that the practice of county licensors who assess whether violations occur can vary among jurisdictions. So in sum, this bill seeks to do a few things. It prohibits publicly posting the order until either the 20-day period to request reconsideration has elapsed, or after the agency's completed the process if the provider sought reconsideration. And I'll note that providers are still required to post the COs in a public place at their facility. And there is also still online a summary of the action on the public lookup page. So that transparency is still there. It's just like not the letter. And then the bill prohibits the letter itself from being public and requires some sort of summary information that alleviates that sort of laundry list problem that I mentioned before. And then finally, the bill requires the agency to remove the summary document from the public lookup within 10 days of the length of time required to be posted under federal law. So instead of 4 years, it would be 10 days after that 3 years. Again, nothing changes the disciplinary actions that might be enacted to the provider. And I just want to thank, I do have a testifier online. And this is not an area that I have ever delved into before. And we got a lot of technical feedback from DHS over the course of this Bill and Annie has been incredible, and her team answering a million questions, sometimes the same questions multiple times, so they can understand what's going on. So thank you.
Thanks, Representative Mueller. We do have Cindy Cunningham on the line in the Zoom room with us. If you could unmute yourself, Cindy. Thanks for coming back to committee. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good to be here. Can you hear me with all this technical
difficulties? Yes, we can. Thanks so much.
Okay, good. I will keep this brief. Representative Mueller covered quite well. I am Cindy Cunningham. I've been a licensed family child care provider in St. Paul for 27 years, and I'm the current public policy chairperson for Leading Care, which is the 501c3 state association for family child care. I am testifying in support of this bill. We appreciate working with Representative Mueller and my counterpart, Brenda Ruzza. I've got to try to rely on much of what I wrote and what she wrote and what you're hearing to shorten time here. This committee has heard many testimonies this year regarding the heavy-handed and consistent oversight of licensing. There have been bills such as last week's House File 2617 regarding full overhaul of licensing. Thank you, Representative Coulter, for bringing that forward. Leading Care has been involved in the writing and the development of that approach. Bills such as yesterday's House File 2619 by Representative West to have postings be clarified for self-report ensures that programs are accurately portrayed to the public. Complying with licensing rules, keeping children safe and holding those responsible when this doesn't happen is of the highest priority of our organization. We do lose providers due to the fear of agency action and personal condemnation in the public. There are two separate pieces, the correction orders. We, right now, reconsideration happens in 20 days. We're asking that those not be posted until that 20-day and where the provider has a chance to consider that reconsideration. There's also a dynamic, which I refer to as first in, first believe. Whatever is made public is considered fact and must be disproved. Postponing posting correction orders until a program is chosen to ask or not ask offers that the post will be complete. Correction orders are not always correct. You've heard the testimony from others about this fact. DHS is choosing to not consistently train and communicate with licensors and chooses not to communicate interpretations to family child care programs. This leads to confusion and inconsistencies in the issue of correction orders.
Ms. Cunningham, if you could wrap up.
Yes.
Thank you. We also do have your written testimony in our packets. Thank you so much.
Okay, yep. All right. We just really hope that this, I've actually worked on this for about 7 years, and the LIL is being updated along with the hub, and this just looks like a good time to try to bring this letter and this correction order process into current as respectful to providers. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. Any members of the public wishing to speak on House File 1897 today? Seeing none, we will close public testimony and move to member discussion and questions. Representative McDonald.
Madam Chair, just quickly, thank you for this bill. This is one of those checklists that I'm not the only one, but heard from daycare providers, and that some who were cleared of any violation, sometimes even very minor, and yet their reputation was stained. So this certainly is a good bill, and Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, I hope that this certainly, I can't imagine this would have a fiscal cost to it, so hopefully we can, or at least something minor or major, something that we can certainly pass on to help our daycare providers. That's all I have to say.
Representative Mueller, do you want to address?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do need to make sure fiscal notes requested on the DE because we just got the DE language, so making sure that's been submitted. I'm seeing thumbs up. Thank you. Thank you for your comments too, Representative McDonald.
Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller. You maybe mentioned this in your opening or part of it, and I may have missed it. On the effective date on 2.12 of the DE, it's talking about January 1, 2026, or upon federal approval, whichever is later. I don't see many of those, and I'm curious if you can just fill me in on why that's written that way.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this was an issue with the timing, whether or not we'd be out of compliance with federal law. And nonpartisan research staff did a survey of like every single state to figure out what the timing was. And so we think this will be in compliance, but we still heard back from the agency when we asked for feedback that they weren't sure because they can't look at every single state to see if they're in compliance or not. And so we put that the federal approval language in there just to alleviate that concern that we heard from the agency.
Representative Doe.
So then is it fair to say that regardless of federal approval, it's effective on January 1st, whichever is later? Is it, I mean, it, so it will become effective January 1st, 2026, as long, am I reading this crooked?
The way that I'm reading it, and perhaps we could have Ms. Mock walk us through, is that it would be effective on January 26th unless it's not approved by the federal government.
I read it as or. It's one or the other.
Ms. Mock, can you shed some light on this for us, please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So it would go into effect whichever is later. So if there isn't federal approval, it would not go into effect, is the idea.
Thank you.
Representative Sansomira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Mueller, for bringing this bill. I have a question that I'm not sure if it's you or actually more for anyone else on the committee, but I'm just wondering a little bit, and I think this is just me being a new to the committee and trying to get a sense of kind of all of the licensing requirements and out there. I know that last week, and I'm just looking at it, but I'm not super dug into the language about Chair West's bill around posting licensing actions for 2 years, and then I heard you say 3 years, and so I'm just a little confused, and I'm also kind of wondering maybe how what you are trying to do with this bill might interact with Chair West's bill around trying to have. It seemed like we were kind of moving in a direction of posting for longer. This is maybe posting for less time. So just trying to get a sense of kind of committee's intentions with these various bills. Thank you. I'm not sure if that's the question for you, but thank you.
Representative Mueller, do you want to have Representative West comment on the potential
that
interplay?
That would be great because I'm not sure what your bill is, and I do feel like I have heard 2 years for posting somewhere, and I was looking at my notes, and I don't remember what that's about.
Very good. Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill, Representative Mueller, and thank you for the question. Let's just now thank you, Altendorf, and thank you. Okay. All right. So great. I like Mueller's bill. I think it actually does a little more for providers than my bill. So if there was a conflict, I would say Mueller's bill, let's just do Mueller's bill. But I think we could figure out a way to do it because as my self-reporting bill is currently, I just talked with the department, and they believe it'll be doable. They believe it'll be almost no effort, but need to verify it. The two-year thing, I actually don't know. I don't remember talking about a two-year posting, but I'm being waved at by a genius.
Ms. Mock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the two bills do different things. So Representative West's bill from the other day has to do with the posting that has to be at the actual child care provider's facility. And so that has to be posted for 2 years at the facility. And Representative West's bill would have made that posting longer if there were some sort of memorandum of maltreatment investigation. This bill, Representative Mueller's bill, has to do with the posting that goes on LIL or the licensing lookup tool. And those on that site, that lookup site, the postings are currently up for 4 years. So this would change it to just comply with whatever federal law is.
That's helpful. Chair West, follow up?
I didn't even follow what bill we were talking about, apparently. Ms. Mock nailed it, so.
This is why we have such amazing nonpartisan staff to guide us on the journey of lawmaking. Representative Zalesdikar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. I think that when we can be clear for families with these child care surveys and licensing and summarizing and then having a way for them to do reconsiderations, I think that that is the path. This is what's happened for nursing homes and assisted living, and these databases are important for the public to understand scope and to make decisions. But when they're not used to the acronyms and the terminology that the departments use, they are not always evaluating them in the way they think. And so I commend you for doing this. I think it's an important step. It's something we want to make sure that the facilities are doing fantastic jobs, are honored for doing that. And this, I think, will give them a lot more feelings of respect, mutual respect, when they fix things timely and are doing their best. Thank you.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Chair Mueller and Chair West and nonpartisan. I'm getting clarity that there's kind of two different systems. There's what you are posting physically in the center, and there's also this lookup. I think my question is, so as I understand it, Chair West's bill that we previously heard was about extending the posting to 10 years if there was maltreatment for the actual posting inside the center, and your bill is related specifically to online. I guess I'm wondering, you know, if the intention I understood of Chair West's bill was if there's maltreatment, we want families to know about that for longer because that's a very serious licensure violation compared to things that we know and have talked about with this committee. They're much less serious. Under this bill, if there was the maltreatment, would it fall under having less time where it is being posted online?
Ms. Mock.
Thank you. So under this bill, the posting for the maltreatment investigation would be online for the length of time that federal law requires, which I believe is 3 years right now. On the licensing lookup tool, all these licensing actions are posted for 4 years.
Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you. So maybe that's just something for this committee to consider. If we're looking to extend the amount of time to 10 years that families can know about maltreatment through a physical posting at the center, it seems like there could be a good argument for consistency around that in terms of the lookup. So I guess what I understood the spirit of West's bill doing is kind of trying to separate maltreatment specifically of saying some minor infractions, you know, we can let those pass, but maltreatment is so serious that we need kind of a longer look back for that. And so I just feel like that's something for this committee to consider, that if we're going to say that online or that in person you need to post it for 10 years, maybe we should have the same consideration for online. Thank you.
Representative Mueller, any feedback on that?
No, I mean, I'm certainly, as always, Madam Chair and Representative Sensenmura, always welcome any kind of feedback. I mean, I will say there is, I think, a little bit of a difference having it in the center versus people online just like quickly looking at things. And to Representative Zlesnikar's point, they don't necessarily understand what that means. And then they're just automatically like excluding that center from even consideration. And of course, if they're considering it and they're going to the center and there are these things posted, I think there could be an argument for maybe having different timelines. But other than that, I don't really have like a strong opinion about it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Don't have any other members on the list for comments. So if you have anything else that you'd like to share? Otherwise, we can lay your bill over.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the discussion today. And again, thanks to Ms. Mock and her team for answering many, many questions and helping with this bill.
Right. Members, House File 1897 is laid over. And off you go back to public safety just across the hall. Thanks for joining us, and good luck.
Is it Blue Day?
It might be Blue Day. All right, members, next on the agenda, we're going to move my bill, House File 1383. We're also going to be laying that over. So I'm going to give the gavel to Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Katizawatun. While you get situated, Chair Katizawatun moves the House File 1383 before the committee. Once you're ready, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All right. Members and Minnesotans, as we find ourselves facing extraordinarily difficult
federal spending proposals that could very well exacerbate the challenges of our state's finances. Today, I want to shine a light on a brighter future. Families across Minnesota are struggling to cover household expenses like groceries and rent. And on top of those basic essentials, young parents continue to struggle to find and afford high-quality early care and learning options for their kids. Often, we can find it difficult to empathize with our neighbors or value just how much a policy would impact them until we, too, are in the trenches. And as a mom of four kids who is still paying childcare costs until our youngest starts kindergarten in the fall, I, too, share that struggle. Parents know that it is our responsibility, or our responsibility to our kids doesn't end when we punch the clock into our workday. And that's one of the many reasons I think that representation is so necessary here at the Capitol. So parents of young children like Chair West, Representative Sensenmira, myself, and so many of others are living these challenges, and we are here to make change. Over the last 6 years, really, I've worked closely with other legislators, advocates, parents, providers, and early childhood educators to bring forward a number of proposals for consideration. And the 2023 session was truly historic in terms of our investments for children and families in housing, in healthcare, in education, and in early care and learning. Members, during the first Trump administration in 2016, the Department of Health and Human Services established a federal benchmark for child care copay at 7% of family income. And so basically what that means is that, in their opinion, a family is able to, or should be able to, spend not more than 7% of their household income on child care and early learning. So for reference, just another common financial recommendation is that individuals should spend less than 30% of their income on housing, whether that's rent or a mortgage. However, in reality, here in Minnesota, my lived experience and so many other fellow parents who have shared with us, they're spending twice their mortgage payment and sometimes more on child care alone. So here in Minnesota, in order to pay no more than 7% of their annual income for early care and education of just one infant child, a family would have to make $243,000 a year. And for one preschool-aged child, families would need to earn around $185,000 a year annually. If you have more than one child, obviously that cost goes up. With the incredible insight and experiences from providers and advocates, I'm working with Senator Grant Housechild, and we have created a proposal that will build on the work of this committee and benefit even more families across the state. We see a tremendous gap in support for almost 75% of Minnesota families, those who earn more than approximately $60,000 a year, and we know these families continue to struggle with the cost of early care and learning. The Great Start Affordability Program is similar to my Great Start Child Care Tax Credit that we heard earlier in the session. This is an alternate way, in lieu of a tax credit, to get much-needed dollars back in the hands of Minnesota families. The Great Start Affordability subsidies and scholarships will be designed on a sliding scale in terms of annualized income and number and age of the children. The Great Start Affordability Program will help families like Daniel, who is a single father of two boys who currently earn beyond the level of subsidies provided in Minnesota and continue to support the existing lower income families. Daniel was denied an early learning scholarship because he earned $63,000 a year pre-tax. Much like the design of the Great Start Child Care Tax Credit, the Great Start Affordability Program aims to fill that gap for families who are still struggling to make ends meet, who earn up to 150% of the state median income, which is about 85% of the families in Minnesota with children under the age of five. The Great Start Affordability Program would provide a subsidy directly to child care providers on behalf of Minnesota families based on the enrollment and participation of one or more of their children. These subsidies would be scaled by income. So as we move forward, we will continue working closely with advocates, providers, and the Department of Children, Youth, and Families in order to determine the system requirements and the frequency of these payments. The hope is that this Great Start Affordability Program can utilize our existing Early Childhood Scholarships Program, which continue to receive an incredible amount of bipartisan support. Just had our conversation yesterday on Chair West's bill, and utilizing and improving the existing system and structure will also allow us to provide these payments much quicker, ensuring that families see lower childcare costs as soon as possible.
With that, I would like to invite my testifiers to share their thoughts.
Thank you, Chair. And it sounds like we have Elena Skoglund up first. Elena, you're online. If you'd like to unmute and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi, can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
All right, good afternoon, Chair Khatiza Watoon and members of the committee. I understand that the schedule is just rearranged to meet my childcare needs, so thank you very much. My name is Elena Skoglund. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HF1383. I am the parent of two boys, ages 3 years and 4 months, and I'm also a childcare teacher at Minnesota State University Moorhead's Early Education Center, where I teach 3- and 4-year-olds. My son Harvey is in the room just down the hall from me. My husband works full-time as a police officer for the city of Holly. We always wanted to have children close in age, but we were nervous to bring our 4-month-old Dean into the world. I'm not exaggerating when I say that the cost of childcare was the number one factor. At the upper end of the pay scale for childcare teachers, even as families are paying much more than they can afford, I still only make $19.27 an hour. We pay $1,200 every month for childcare for Dean, and we also pay $1,200 every month for childcare for Harvey. That's $2,400 a month. That's almost $30,000 a year. It's my entire paycheck plus some of my husband's paycheck to pay for our childcare. We're not an outlier. However, we are the norm. While I'm grateful that assistance exists to help families with the lowest incomes, what about the majority of Minnesota families like mine who make too much to qualify for assistance, but not nearly enough to comfortably afford our bills? We're doing everything we've been told we were supposed to do to be successful, getting a college degree, being in a stable marriage, doing jobs that help our community, but it's no longer enough to even scrape by. We are two full-time working parents, working in careers that are vital to a thriving community, and we can barely support two children. We need teachers and we need police officers, and for us and others to do these jobs well, we need and deserve high-quality childcare that's affordable. HF 1383 will provide funding to reduce childcare costs significantly for so many Minnesota families like mine. I urge you to support this bill and make it possible for families to afford their lives. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for being flexible with us. Hopefully we got you in just in time. Thanks so much. Next up to testify is Alexandria Packard. You can make your way to the testifier table. And once you're situated, feel free to introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Welcome to the Littles as well.
Chair Khatiza Watoon and members of the committee. My name is Alexandria Packard. I am grateful for the opportunity to share my story with you in support of HF 1383. I have a 6-year-old son who is in kindergarten and a 2.5-year-old daughter. I work full-time from home. I work full-time from home in the Fairview healthcare system. My husband works full-time for the Canadian Pacific Railroad. He travels Monday through Friday for his job, which leaves me single parenting during the work week. We do not qualify for child care assistance, yet our income is low enough that if Minnesota met its goal to have... You can have a minute. Yep. Yet our income is low enough that if Minnesota met its goal to have no family pay more than 7% of their income for child care and early learning, child care would nearly be free for us. Last year, when my son was still in child care before starting kindergarten, we could only afford part-time child care for him, and we could not afford child care for my daughter. On the days that he was at child care, I took care of my daughter and worked at the same time, which was as challenging as you are imagining. 2 days a week, they spent with my grandmother, their great-grandmother, because we could not afford child care. With my son in kindergarten, we can only afford to have my daughter in child care 3 days a week. My grandmother still cares for her 2 days a week. Even with one child in public school, it feels like our situation is still the same, okay, only shifted to the other child. We still have the same questions all the time. How do we pay for this? How can we manage this? What do we do if my grandmother gets sick? How will we need to change our child care arrangements if I get called back into office full time? If HF 1383 were to pass and become a reality, many, if not most, of those questions would have answers. We could afford to put my daughter in child care full time, and my grandmother could enjoy time with her great-grandchildren without having to be completely responsible for them for full days. Every month, we have to pick and choose between which bills to pay and how much we can save. It's not a fun way to live. It shouldn't be this hard for two full-time working parents with two children to live without this stress. I urge you to pass this bill and positively change the lives of Minnesota families like ours. We are doing everything we can, and it's still not enough. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here, and thank you to the kiddos. You guys are so well-behaved. Thank you for so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome here. Members, any discussion? I'm sorry, are there any members from the public that wish to testify on this bill? Okay, we'll close to public testimony, seeing none. And member discussion, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to say thank you, Chair Katizi-Witun, for bringing this forward. And I think it's worth remembering kind of what numbers we're talking about here, because these are families who make too much to qualify for child care assistance or early learning scholarships. And the upper limit is 150% of state median income, which basically works out to two parents earning around $66,000 a year. So we're talking about middle class families. And I think it goes to show just how stupid expensive, not stupid, how very expensive child care is, and how many Minnesotans are really struggling to afford quality child care. And when you think about the fact that we're talking about young parents, folks who are at the lower end of their earnings potential, it really just is holding so many folks back. And so, I'm proud to be a co-author on this bill. I think this is just an incredibly important conversation that we need to keep having.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. Any other members with questions? Chair Katizi-Witun, would you like to respond to Representative Coulter's? Any comments?
I appreciate the support.
Thank you. Any other questions? Chair West.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Katizi-Witun, for bringing this bill. Do you have an idea of how much this bill would cost?
Chair Katizi-Witun.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Chair West. this is a very expansive bill in that we would be attempting to provide a somewhat of a subsidy to 85% of the children and families in the state of Minnesota. It would be about $500 million a year. It's a very expensive program. What we need to, I think, focus on is that families are dealing with this cost burden right now, and with little to no public support. When we look at the scale of public investment, whether at the state level or the federal level, investment in children across the country under the age of five, when they are eligible to begin kindergarten, is only in the couple of hundreds of dollars. When they begin kindergarten, public investment jumps up to about $13,000 per child per year. So there is this tremendous gap when families are facing student loan payments, car payments, rent or mortgage that continues to grow, and the public is not investing in these little kids. So I think that, you know, we need to continue to have that conversation, and how families are shouldering this burden alone right now, and look at all the ways that we can potentially help. But yes, it is very costly.
Thank you, Chair. Any follow-up, Chair West?
Thank you. Is this designed to allocate money to the parents who then use it on child care, or what is the direct mechanism?
Chair Katizi-Witun.
Thank you for the question. So this the way that we have written the program, the idea is that the state would, through a payment portal, issue prospective payments to providers, which is actually a really critical piece of it. Right now, providers are paid retrospectively, so they need to request funds after children have already come to the daycare for the month. And so instead of the funds being
issued directly to the families, the state would issue these subsidies to the provider and the parents would see a discount on their invoices marked as, you know, Great Start affordability subsidy or scholarship.
Thank you, Chair. Any follow-up, Chair West?
And is that discount or subsidy, does that, how, what time period? Is that a weekly thing? And my, I asked the question to about if the family moves a daycare provider. Does it address that?
Chair Katizwitin.
Thank you. That also a good question. The program at this point is structured to be a monthly subsidy payment that would go directly to the provider on behalf of the family. And yeah, we would definitely want to make sure that there is a tracking mechanism if a family is switching providers or you know, moving out of the state, whatever some of those extenuating circumstances may be.
Thank you, Chair. Any follow-up, Chair West?
Well, one last. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're the boss.
That is untrue. thank you, Madam Chair. So what we briefly mentioned yesterday about melding programs, I mean, this is a lofty goal, and as somebody who pays my, well, who will pay in a month my entire legislative salary in daycare costs after taxes, I relate. Unfortunately, $500 million, what I bring up yesterday is the melding of programs. So when we're talking about colossal programs like this, I like programs that follow the parents, which this basically does. We need to be thinking in what is this displacing? And I like the idea of displacing a lot and focusing on this, especially because this covers a lot more people. However, the idea of 7% sounds so wonderful. So wonderful. I can tell you, I would have another new car or something if I only had to do 7%. It'd be glorious. But that is a goal that we likely will not attain. But as we work to cut costs as a committee as a whole for the providers and provide money for parents, I believe we can slowly chug our way there. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair West. And thank you, Chair Katizwitin, for answering those questions. I think it's really helpful for everybody. I think it really sheds light on the importance to raise revenue this year and in the coming years as well. Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Katizwitin, for continuing to be an advocate and champion for this issue. You know, I think I'm glad that we're hearing this bill today in conjunction with Representative Coulter's bill around the Great Start compensation, because I think, you know, we as a committee need to continue to kind of hold our two goals, which is affordable child care for families, no family paying more than 7% of their income, and more than a livable wage for the folks that are doing the work of caring for our kids, which I know, you know, we have talked about that being a starting teacher salary, which is far from where it is right now. You know, I agree with Chair West's assessment that this is, you know, a very large proposal that probably does not meet what is possible this year. But I do think looking out, you know, in every committee, we are having so many conversations about our population and diminishing birth rates and what it means to have an aging population without, you know, having babies and next generations that are kind of filling that gap. And so, you know, when we think about that and we think about the challenges that we're going to have from kind of our population changes, I think that it makes sense to put some really big investments to try to stem the tide on that. I think especially, you know, when you hear that the federal government may be allocating, you know, Department of Transportation projects related to birth rates, mm-hmm. like, you know, I think how are we incentivizing and supporting people to want to have kids? And I, you know, we heard from testifiers that a huge barrier is just people thinking about childcare costs. So I think we need to just keep pushing for this kind of investment, not only because it's maybe morally right, but because it will be good for the economy of our state. We need to make it easier for people to have kids, and we know that childcare is a huge burden. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. Any follow-up to that, Chair Katizwitin?
I think I'll address that in my closing comments if there are any
other questions. Any other member discussion? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Vice Chair. I will make this quick. Just a question to our chairs. In the beginning of our committee hearings, we talked about reducing the cost of daycare in Minnesota because we are the seventh highest in the nation. And the bills that we saw earlier in committee were bills that kind of etched away at some of that overregulation and mandates that increased the cost. But now we're seeing bills just money after money after money after money for funding. We simply don't have it there. We don't have a finite form of cash to continue the programs of giving out money. So as chairs, as you're crafting the bills, what percentage are we, as you look at the bills that we've passed already, that could make it into an omnibus bill that would lower the cost of these very expensive daycare for our families?
Chair Katizowatin.
Thank you, and thank you for the question, Representative McDonald. Chair West and I are making some really tough decisions over the next couple of days, and we'll be both working with our individual caucuses to lift up priorities. Of course, we want to do whatever we can to reduce the cost of childcare. A program like this and a program like the Early Learning Scholarships Bill that we heard yesterday would lower the out-of-pocket cost for families, right? So we have to look carefully, right, at the different regulations that would lower the cost of care or just lower the cost of doing business potentially. So I think that there are a lot of variables to kind of weigh. And so I think that the conversations that we've had so far this session really ground us in the reality of what it is like to be a childcare provider, what it is like to be a parent, attempting to raise children in today's day and age. And I think one of the ways that we continue to move forward is hearing bills that are perhaps aspirational at this point in time. You know, we know that this bill is beyond our spending limit. Chair West's bill yesterday is beyond the spending limit at what we brought it in, what we introduced it as. And but legislation, I think, gets better over time as we continue talking about the issue and bringing in the ideas and suggestions of people in the industry and parents who are living these difficulties. So, we are anticipating hearing our budget bill next week. So stay tuned.
Thank you, Chair Katizowatin. Representative McDonald, any follow-up? All right. Any other member discussion? All right, seeing none, it's back to you, Chair.
Thank you so much, everybody, for the discussion today. Like I said just now, the Great Start Affordability Program is an aspirational goal, right? We're moving in the direction of lowering the out-of-pocket cost for families in here in Minnesota, while hopefully allowing our providers to earn a thriving wage in this critical role that they play in helping us all raise our children. I just want to be clear that the Great Start Affordability Program is not about throwing money at a problem, but it is a series of precise policy changes and fiscal investments to reform early care and learning in Minnesota. It's not the same old, and, you know, to Chair West's point about melding programs, I think ideally, you know, we would like to streamline the variety of income streams that we have in this space right now, potentially combine Child Care Assistance Program, the Early Learning Scholarships Program, into one Great Start program. So we can continue having those conversations. But we are all well aware of the financial realities ahead of us. Minnesotans are facing these challenges already. Future parents are making decisions about their future and the future of our state, which impacts the size of their family on a micro level and the economy of our state on a macro level. So I think that this is just such an important discussion, continuing to hear from parents like we had today, continuing to hear from providers like we did earlier, and really making sure that we continue moving forward and not sticking our heads in the mud when we look at the challenges that we face. So I appreciate everyone's input and look forward to building a brighter future with all of you.
Thank you, Chair. And with that, House File 1383 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you so much. And as Chair Katizowatin makes her way, do you have a comment? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, should we hear the other bill that I have while I'm right up here? Because I think it should
be. We can do that, absolutely. Give me 1 second to find it. All right, so next bill will be House File 2863 from Chair Katizowatin. Want to go ahead and present your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a vehicle bill that Representative West and I have discussed and agreed to send on to the General Register. As we do face a first and second deadline this Friday, this is our last hearing before the deadline, and we want to make sure that we cover our bases in the case that potential policy needs to make it further down the road without the opportunity for a referral without the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair. Any member discussion? Not. Oh, Chair West, go ahead.
Beep, beep.
This is a vehicle bill. I was going to say, there's not usually a lot of discussion about vehicle bills, so thank you for confirming that. with no further member discussion, all those in favor of referring House File 2863 to the General Register, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And that's that. House File 2863 is moving to the General Register. As the chair makes her way back to the table, the next bill on the docket is from Representative Coulter. And Representative Coulter will make his way to the table. It is House File 2728, members. And here is Chair Katizwatun.
Representative Coulter, we are going to be laying your bill over, so when you are ready, feel free to kick it off.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm here with House File 2728, which makes some changes to the Great Start Compensation Support Program. So by way of background, the Great Start Compensation Support Program was passed as part of our 2023 budget with the goal of really being a continuation of pandemic-era federal supports for our child care providers. And these were put in place because we know, as is so often said, that our child care providers really are the workforce behind the workforce. And so these instituted direct payments to providers who are actively caring for children to boost their wages that we already know are already at the bottom end of what many professionals make. And we also know that the Great Start Compensation Support Program has made a difference. We know that it's raised wages for providers, and it's helped keep more providers in work and more centers open. So what House File 2728 does is really just expand what time providers can consider or can be considered by providers counting toward that 32 hours a week to receive these payments. And specifically, this would include participating in professional development or training or lesson planning. And I think, you know, this is important not only, of course, to recognize the real scope of the work that providers do, but I think, you know, in very much sort of continuing on with a theme that I have, really recognizing that providers are educators. And we, you know, very often provide financial support and paid time for educators to receive this kind of professional development. I think my kids have like 8 days more off of school this year because the Bloomington School District is increasing those days for PD. So, you know, it is, I think, also important to know that the payments must still go to compensating paid staff who regularly and directly care for children. And those are current requirements for licensing as well. And it would not expand payments to include anyone who is not already receiving them. So with that, I will turn over to my testifiers who will hopefully be more articulate than I have been.
Right. First on our list, we have Brandy Skroga-Coons. Is she joining us in person today? Oh, wonderful. You can approach the testifiers table and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Katizwatun and members of the community. And good to see you again, Chair West. Thank you for having me. It is a challenging as a child care provider to get here in person, and I appreciate the attention you're giving to my testimony, especially after today as I traveled through rain, sleet, ice, and snow to be here. My name is Brandy Skroga-Coons, and I'm the Executive Director of Creative Kids Academy. which has 13 locations. I have worked in childcare for nearly 27 years. I am here to testify in support of House File 2728, the Great Start Compensation Grants. I cannot overstate the impact of these grants. They are a literal lifesaver for childcare providers in Minnesota. They have helped us hire and retain qualified staff and stay competitive with other centers. If we had tried to offer the same benefits and compensation to staff without the grants, our business would have lost $700,000 just last year. This would have meant closing classrooms due to the struggle to find qualified teachers that fit into our budget and increasing tuition even more for families than we already did to make that up. Since the original COVID grants required us to offer additional compensation to our staff, we would have had to take away compensation from staff in Minnesota had not implemented these grants. Would you stay at a job if your employer lowered your wages? We appreciate the flexibility with the compensation grants. We've created a life essentials fund. Teachers use this money to pay their bills, make necessary car repairs, pay their own children's activities, and yes, take vacations, because they deserve it and need to take vacations to be able to do this work. We also do a thankful bonus around the holidays so staff don't feel pinched. The flexibility to include hours spent participating in professional development or training or lesson planning added in this bill will make an impact. We are closed 2 days a year for professional development. We also have monthly staff meetings, these hours that are integral to this work. As the budget comes together, I urge you to remember the building blocks that are necessary for our communities to thrive. Even though this is Representative Coulter's bill, I'd like to quote Representative Senator Mura, who hosted a roundtable with the child care providers last night. Every investment we make in early childhood comes back tenfold. Every disinvestment comes back to haunt us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us and for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Cindy Cunningham. If you're still remote with us, Cindy, if you want to unmute yourself, introduce yourself for the record, and share your brief testimony.
Yeah, and I will try to be more brief. This is Cindy Cunningham, Family Child Care Provider and Lead in Care Public Policy Chair. I attempted to reach Representative Coulter to discuss our concerns with the moving forward of this bill, but we have not been able to connect. We respect the intent to recognize additional hours, which staff and providers invest in the care of children, and we highly value the support of the state through the Great Start Compensation. Our concerns are that the integrity of the program in compensating those working directly with children, and that there's not a system to account for hours not with children. There is an attendance process that will be on the hub, is already on the hub for the centers. And then the sustainability of the program, there is already a reduction slated for the budget, unless that is changed. And asking for more methods to add hours to qualify will lead to more hours being requested. More hours requested leads to more withdrawal from the budget, which leads to lower award amounts, potentially becoming insignificant and therefore minimizing the effectiveness and intent of the program. So the record keeping and the actual dollars amounts that we would be getting through that and how programs would track that is our concern. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. Those are the only two testifiers that we have had signed up. Is there anyone else in the public who wishes to comment on House File 2728? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony and move to member discussion and questions. Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Coulter. You and I were at the White House last summer with other state lawmakers throughout the country to discuss how important it is to bring solutions that can work. And I remember having the conversations of how we could be supportive to those family-owned businesses that provide such nurturing care to our little ones in everyone's district. And the need that those local family-owned businesses have been contacting from my offices in St. Paul to you representing Bloomington. And I just am really happy that I will be supporting this and hope our colleagues can jump on board as well. Thank you.
Members, any further questions or comments on House File 2728? Representative Coulter, closing comments. I'm sorry. Guess what? Chair West wanted to speak, and you told me that, and I forgot. Chair West.
Thank you, Chair Katizo-Tun and Vice Chair Hansen, for turning on my microphone, which I was going to forget. With the Great Start Compensation Program, the way it is funded in the base. There's a base amount of funding, and then there's one-time funding. The base won't cover the current obligations that are going to occur this very year. And when it doesn't cover it, it reduces the overall payments to providers. So a bill expanding who qualifies would literally lower payments to providers, even with no change in the budget. So I do have concerns about that. With I like programs that, if we're going to do it, let's make it consistent. And the expansion, this will just make the decline in payments individually to providers decline faster. Like, it's literally a math problem here. And I do have some concern with that. But I just wanted to make that clear, because also for people invested in the Great Start Compensation Program, even if we change nothing about it, even if we do nothing, people are still likely to see decreased payments over the long term if nothing is done. So that is something that I think people need to be aware of.
Thank you, Chair West. Representative Coulter.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And just quickly to clarify something, I don't think this is what Chair West meant, but this does not, as I said, this does not expand who receives these payments. It just expands the hours for which they can receive them. So the payments still have to go to folks who are directly caring for children. This would just allow them to receive them for hours involving professional development and training and so on. And I don't, like I said, I don't think that's what the chair meant, but I just wanted to make that a little bit clearer. I think as far as the budget, I mean, I think we all, you know, to what Chair Katizawa-Toon said on the last bill, I think we're all certainly aware of the situation in which we find ourselves. But I think it is still important to have conversations about ways that we can continue to support providers. And, you know, these payments, you know, as we've heard today, have been just incredibly successful. They kept providers afloat during the pandemic and have continued to support them afterwards. And Representative Perez Vega mentioned when we were at the White House last fall, I think it was, and I was really, really proud to brag on all the incredible things that we did for childcare and for providers in 2023. And this was one of the things that folks were most curious about. So I would just say in closing, you know, we obviously know that educators' work doesn't begin or end when they're caring for students. And we know that that's true for our childcare providers as well. And so I think this is just a way of fully recognizing the work of what it means to be a child care provider. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Coulter, and for the great discussion today, members. We are going to now lay over House File 2728. I don't know if I have to do that. And next and final bill on the agenda for today is House File 1424 from our very own Vice Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Chair.
Certainly. The plan is also to lay over your bill, Representative Hansen. You do have a few amendments, so we can start with the DE if you like to get the bill in the shape that you'd like to share with us today.
Yes, please, Chair. If we could just start with the DE3 to get us in place, and then before adopting the 4 and 5, I just want to talk a little bit about them and then explain why we're removing them, so that way when I bring the subject up later on, you all have heard about it.
Right. Wonderful. So Vice Chair Hansen moves the DE3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed?
All right.
The motion prevails and the DE3 is adopted. Vice Chair Hansen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair and members. House File 1424 is dense. I recognize that. And it is a shifting gears from the last conversations we were having. So this bill talks about relative kinship licensing and support. And so the DE3 gets the bill into the shape that I want and reflects lots of negotiations between a variety of stakeholders, and it's probably not the end of those negotiations either. I do want to draw your attention to what is the largest packet within your materials. The title is the Kin-Specific Foster Home Approval. It's a really good resource for folks on this committee, and I suggest keeping it and being familiar with it. This goes over what's considered to be the national standards for this, and so I just wanted to flag how great of a resource that is. So House File 1424 was developed out of these national standards and out of a local Kinship Licensing Task Force that included statewide experts, and they worked from April to October of 2024, reviewing the new federal flexibilities that allow states to establish specific licensing standards for relative kin foster caregivers. Their work resulted in the bill that's before you today, as well as more that my DE and my A4 and 5 will also remove, but those are also important pieces. These recently established federal flexibilities are born out of the recognition that our foster care system has made a structural shift to rely on relative kin to provide the majority of our foster care placements. And this is a powerful and positive shift. But as such, our system needs to catch up with this change to actively support those relative kin with licensing and the family supports that are needed to assure family preservation and support that reunification and permanency for the child. In Minnesota, over 60% of child foster care placements are with relative kin caregivers. And this is a substantive shift for our system, and it yields very positive outcomes for our children if we support the policies that allow these structures of our child welfare and foster care system to catch up with this incredibly positive trend. So to achieve these goals, this bill aligns with national kin-specific standards in three really specific ways. Number one, improving the design for relative caregivers to access foster care licensing by increasing system responsiveness with training requirements, aligning background studies to be responsive to relative kin circumstances, and setting goals for a more timely process to support relative kin through the licensing process. Number two, it equips relative kin caregivers with accessible information on the resources that are available specifically to the children in their care and their families. And number three, it increases priority access for childcare for relative kin children. Now, based on some of the feedback from the Kinship Licensing Task Force that we received on the financial needs of caregivers, in tandem with the really big desire to care for relative children despite financial constraints, this bill, as is right now with the DE adopted, proposes that families who open their homes to care for relative children should be exempt from the 60-month MFIP limit over the time frame when they are parenting these relative kin children. But due to significant state cost shares with this provision, I'm going to move the A4 amendment, which will remove this section from the bill. And if I could at this time move that just so we don't forget.
Right. Representative Hansen moves the A4 amendment. Members, any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion prevails and the A4 is adopted. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for letting me talk about these and then remove them kind of as we go along. I felt like that was the easiest way in a bill as complex as this. So the next one is going to be about the A5 amendment, which I am going to, spoiler alert, also have to remove this section. But I wanted to talk to you about this because your packets include a letter from Generations United, who's a national leader that contributed to the development of kin-specific standards for consideration by all states across the nation. And updating Minnesota statute to meet these national best practices is important. And so Section 11 of the bill advances these three key provisions from this section. Or it would if I weren't about to remove it, but you should know about them. So it removes first-degree assault from the list of crimes that are permanently barred to the list of crimes that are barred for 5 years. So rather than someone being permanently barred because they got in a bar fight at 19 years old, we would move this to a 5-year bar, for example. It changes the timeline also of the disqualification for a termination of parental rights from 20 years to 7 years. So if you had a child that you gave up for adoption when you were young and later in life wanted or needed to take foster kin placement of your grandchild or niece or nephew or someone else in the family, it wouldn't restrict you from doing so and providing for your family in that way. And three, it changes the time to start the clock on a 5-year bar time period from the time of conviction to the time of the incident. So we know a lot of times court can take a while to adjudicate, and so we wanted to move it to the time of the of the incident as opposed to the time that court figured out the plea and everything. So this language does align with federal law in the Adam Walsh law and will result hopefully someday in more relative kin being able to be considered for licensure to care for their relative kin children, because these particular pieces of statute do limit a lot of people from being able to take care of their family member. But based on the tight timing of committee hearings, I'm going to move the A5 amendment so that I don't have to go to judiciary. So I would move to adopt the A5 amendment, please.
Right. Representative Hansen moves the A5 amendment. Any further discussion to that motion, members? Right. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the A5 is adopted.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Representative Hansen, please tell us about the remains of your bill.
Thank you so much. So I've taken now two sections out of what was in the DE, and so I can get this document to the rest of the committee. My amazing team put this together, but I'm going to run through each of the sections as quickly as possible just so you know what each section does. I really hate when people come before my committee with a complex bill and don't tell me what each section does. So I'm going to run through those, but I do want to give enough time in committee for folks to talk. So forgive me for doing what I'm good at and talking really fast for a few moments. Section 1 is going to update the definition of individual who is related for child care to increase access to family foster care. Section 2 requires kinship caregivers to receive clear information on resources that they can access to support the child and family unit, and gives the caregivers the ability to choose their licensor and the license and license the relative caregiver and provide background studies to the household. Sections 3 to 6 create flexibility for training requirements for relative caregivers in FASD training and allowing up to 30 days following licensure to complete the SIDS and car seat training, which we've heard about in this committee before, and it requires 6 hours of annual in-service training for those relatives. I think this is important because I have family members who've never had children, so if they were to need to take over for my kids, I would hope that they would get some of this training because they've never taken care of children in their life, so this is really important stuff. Section 7 to 8 includes relative foster caregivers in child care assistance definition of family and the definition of relative kin caregivers as eligible to provide unlicensed child care. Section 9 was removed with the DE. The new Section 9 was removed with my A4. The new Section 10 in the DE adds child welfare definition to child welfare to the definition of relative for background studies in the statute. Section what was 12 and 13 were removed with my DE. What is the new Section 11 in the DE was removed with my A5. So moving on to Section 12, which remains the same as originally, it directs those licensing relative caregivers to advise them about the resources available. The new Section 13 in the DE is a direction to the commissioner, and it requires materials for kinship caregivers to be available in the 20 most common languages, including ASL, and assuring that accessibility for families with disabilities. The new Section 14 in the DE is a direction to the commissioner requiring an update to the foster care licensing guidelines to expedite the licensing process for relative caregivers to be able to be timely and responsive. New Section 15 is an appropriation for support to support relative foster caregivers and to complete licensing and receive family support that assures stability and well-being for the children and families. And then the last section was 18 was removed with my DE. So that's as fast as I can go, and I want to turn it over to my testifiers so they at least have a few minutes to chat about this.
Thank you for that sprint through your bill, Vice Chair Hansen. Whichever the testifiers would like to go first can introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Kathy Duffy, and I work with Quality Parenting Initiative, or QPI, Minnesota. Thank you so much, co-chairs and committee, for your time today and this opportunity to speak on behalf of House File 1424. So a little bit about QPI. We strengthen foster care. We work to strengthen foster care by emphasizing loving parenting as our shared goal for all children. We do that by focusing on lived experience leadership, meaningful relationships, and research-informed services. We provide training and support for county and community-based foster care licensing organizations and others within the child welfare system to be able to implement the practices that improve parent-to-caregiver relationships, increase the focus on child development and decision-making, and bridging knowledge across shareholders.
stakeholders, sorry. QPI leverages the power of relationships and the wisdom of those who've experienced the foster care system firsthand, and I'm here to speak on the role of relative and kinship families who are the experts in caring for their young family members who are involved in child welfare. Building the licensing process to meet the unique needs of relatives is necessary, and your support of House File 1424 can help achieve this. In fall of 2024, we utilized our resources of data collection to gather information from county and community-based foster care licensors regarding licensing barriers. This feedback reinforced that relatives caring for children can be overwhelmed with their responsibilities, which leads to delays in completing licensing requirements. Additional barriers faced include limited free time, difficulty completing paperwork, lack of access to technology, and mistrust of the system. Investing in the licensing and family support required to adequately meet the needs of relative kin caregivers is a must and is achievable. QPI Minnesota has directly gathered feedback from relatives and kinship families, and in our survey on early placement, relatives reported greater satisfaction when three things occurred. One, caseworkers spent time understanding the relative's current relationship with the child's parents. Two, the relative received information on foster care licensing process next steps. And three, the caseworker asked about the relative's needs in order to provide care for the child in their home. This is a testament that formally implementing support to relative and kin families will provide a meaningful impact. Relatives and kins are often working to complete licensure requirements while also navigating their new role as caregivers, and this legislation will improve responsiveness, communication, and ongoing care that is needed for these families. When our relatives and kin are supported, so are the children they care for. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for sharing your experience. The next testifier may introduce herself and proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Kadzia Watun and Co-Chair West and committee members. My name is Christina Zizi. I'm the Executive Director of Ampersand Families here in support of House File 1424. Ampersand Families was founded 17 years ago to help prevent older youth in foster care from aging out of foster care by finding them safe, loving, and permanent families through adoption. Over time, our work has evolved to prioritize family preservation and relative kin connections whenever possible. We believe this is the best for the youth we work with and their families, and child welfare research demonstrates this as well. We work alongside families to address their unique needs, but this is difficult as we're working within a system that is designed for non-relative families. This system often creates barriers in our work to get relative and kin families licensed. It is important that families are licensed, as relatives cannot be considered a permanent placement option in court until they have an approved home study, which is part of the licensing process. We have had a number of relatives over the years who are a race against time to get through all of the hoops and hurdles of their home study so they could be considered in a court because the counties wanted to bypass them in favor of the non-relative foster family. Therefore, we support these changes to address and mitigate these barriers, including a standard for licensing and support specifically designed for relatives that will help us do our work with relative families more effectively and efficiently. We can address these barriers for families and ensure basic needs are met for families and they can experience well-being and the kind of stability that benefits children and families. For example, we are currently working with a relative caregiver whose relative child was consistently on the run and engaging in unhealthy and unsafe behaviors. Since we placed this youth with a relative, this youth has not run away a single time, is doing better in school, and is no longer engaging in these behaviors. I cannot state strongly enough the impact of a youth being placed with someone they know, and we all need to continue to find more innovative ways to support this work. We appreciate the flexibility in this bill, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you so much. Finally, we have Sean McKnight. You can approach the testifiers table. Maybe we can do a little switch around up there. And please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you all for being with us today.
Committee, hello, my name is Sean McKnight. I am a 27-year veteran of law enforcement. For 12 years worked mostly crimes against people, sex crimes against children, child pornography cases, other violence against children. I'm a member of a coalition, which is a group of 30 frontline professionals who care for victims of child abuse directly and child abuse pediatricians, law enforcement, mental health practitioners, social workers, and others. I'm here to speak for the coalition. We strongly oppose proposals in this bill regarding the lowering of the bar for eligibility for kin provider foster care. While we believe that foster children staying with kin is optimal when safe, we are concerned that proposed changes to the kinship foster care eligibility could endanger children who are already traumatized. The primary purpose of foster care placement, whether with relatives or others, is to ensure the safety and well-being of the child. Specifically, here are the three items of concern. Background checks on juveniles in the home. Minnesota currently requires background checks on children starting at age 13. This bill recommends to move the background checks to age 16. I was just told that was potentially removed. Mm-hmm. And if that's true, I apologize.
Sorry, Chair. I was making eyes with my members who were looking at me going, wait, what? And I said, no, that part was removed. So,
okay.
And I can update folks on that too, but I didn't want to interrupt your testimony. I'm so sorry.
That's fine. And right. There will be a portion in here where, based on what I heard for testimony, may have already been removed, but I'm going to state it to ensure that our point's being made.
Absolutely. You can make sure that it's on the record, Mr. McKnight. Thank you.
Thank you. Background checks are a critical tool to assess the suitability of individuals and households where foster children will be placed. Unfortunately, some juveniles may have a history of criminal or sexual offenses. These checks do not penalize individuals, but provide vital information to protect children. Reducing the scope of background checks limits that information and increases potential risk. Secondly, removing specific violent crimes from permanent disqualifications. This also may be removed, which I'm not sure of the proceedings here. I'm sorry.
She's taking your input already, Mr. McKnight, and moving forward.
You could just
wrap up relatively quickly.
I've literally got about a minute.
Great.
The bill suggests removing manslaughter, criminal vehicular homicide, arson, carjacking, first or second degree felony interference, and others. So quickly, the question the court has found beyond a reasonable doubt the offenders committed this. These are individuals with a history of violent crimes, exhibit traits of this. The best predictor of future performance is past history. And we want to remove children from these abusive situations. Thirdly, and this one may also have been removed, reducing disqualification periods for termination of parental rights or otherwise TPR. The reduction in the disqualification period from 20 years to 5 years. The termination of parental rights is a serious process not taken lightly by the courts, and except in rare circumstances from significant parental abuse or neglect. Even voluntary TPRs may be pleas that were made so that the individual, by an individual who appeared in court. A child is removed from
Mr. McKnight, I apologize for interrupting you. We're over time, and so I'm going to need to ask you to stop.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us, though. We don't have time for any other members of the public to comment on this, but I know that Vice Chair Hansen takes input very seriously, so feel free to email her.
Can I just wrap up?
Certainly.
Thank you so much, committee. I do want to just recognize that there were some letters in the packet and that everybody on this coalition has worked super, super hard together. So as you've heard, feedback like this had come in before, which is why it was included in the DE. And if the chairs want to bring this back up at a future point and put me up here in the hot seat to ask so the committee can ask me questions. I know that it stinks when you don't get to ask the author questions. So I'm here, but you're welcome to talk to me offline as well. And with that, I will, because of the sake of time, give it back to you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Vice Chair Hansen. Members, we will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion and maybe a policy bill. So appreciate your patience today. And with that, we are adjourned.